Many years ago, Riley Knight completed a degree in history. This proved to be a bad move, as it was absolutely useless for him. Until now, here's some half-assed history.
What's going on, mate? Great to have you along for some more half-assed history. This week on the agenda, going to be having a chat about Gregor MacGregor, a bloke who had some of the most ridiculous and outlandish adventures you've ever heard in 19th century Latin America. I actually found out about this bloke through a listener, Casper Legras. I don't know how to say it. With a name like that, you're asking for trouble sending in emails to me. I'm never going to get it right. Casper Legras. Who sent through an email with a suggestion to have a look into old MacGregor as a topic for an episode. And I'll tell you what, we've got a two-parter on our hand because there is so much meat on these bones. His story is absolutely ridiculous. I can't believe I'd never heard of this bloke. And you're not going to believe it either once you find out what this bloke got up to. So MacGregor, he was a British soldier, and he sort of became obsessed with like status and position and prestige, and basically looked like a big important knob. And he used this status and prestige and this sort of illusion of grandeur that he had like this to trick people into believing all sorts of ridiculous stuff. His adventures took him all across the Atlantic, all around the world, and he fought in revolutionary wars in Latin America. While he's doing this, he managed to fool and take advantage of everyone he met. He turned all these small successes that he had here and there into this huge reputation for military brilliance and overaccomplishment. As I say, he fought for Venezuelan independence. He invented fake chivalric orders. He planned an invasion of Florida. And on three separate occasions, he captured towns that belonged to the Spanish before escaping just before the Spanish came back and then recaptured them. He left them defenseless. So, he absolutely diddled sort of everyone with all of his tricks. Everyone thought he was this high-ranking aristocratic strategic heavyweight. But the biggest diddle of all actually came after his days as a soldier. We're going to talk about that next week. This week, we're going to set the stage, have a chat about what this bloke got up to as a soldier and some of the adventures and misadventures he had because they're absolutely wild. Absolutely wild, these are the first half of his career. So let's get to it. So, All the way back now to 1786, Christmas Eve, 24th of December, in fact, when Gregor MacGregor was born in Stirlingshire in Scotland. Now, I live about an hour away from where he was born near Loch Katrin, and a beautiful part of the world it is. He's born into a relatively well-heeled Catholic family that's part of Clan Gregor or Clan MacGregor. He's actually a descendant of Rob Roy, who you may have heard of, a Scottish outlaw, and later in life, he claims to be the descendant of people involved in the Darien Scheme. People who listened to episode number 50 will know all about the Darien Scheme, Scotland's ill-fated attempt to colonise Central America. Anyway, MacGregor's dad dies when he's just a kid. He's only 8 years old, and he's raised by his mum alongside two sisters. Now, he follows in the footsteps of his dad, he joins the military at the age of 16 in 1803. So both his dad and his granddad were part of the British military, and specifically our mate MacGregor, he joins the army. His family paid for a commission for him, giving him the rank of ensign in a company called the 57th Regiment of Foot. And I did some reading about this, about the purchasing of commissions, and it's actually very, very interesting to discover that back in the day, before 1871, British military ranks were purchased rather than earned. Ranks all up to colonel were actually bought and sold by officers in the British Army, which ensured only rich people were in charge of troops, and this had a number of sort of knock-on effects that the British Army were actively seeking. It meant that the officers were, likely happy with the status quo. They benefited from things being the way they are with the amount of money they had, and therefore they wouldn't rise up in rebellion and bring their troops with them. Also did stuff like prevented looting and profiteering from war, with these officers, again, being presumably well cared for by the fact that they're very wealthy. On top of this, weirdly, and I probably won't surprise you to learn this, those who actually did earn their ranks over, years and years of actual hard work were looked down on by the snooty rich kids who had just bought their way in. Anyway, the whole purchase of commissions actually ended in 1871 after the Franco-Prussian War, because the Prussian army absolutely wiped the floor with the French. I'd love to cover that, the Battle of Sedan, that sort of stuff, absolutely fascinating, because it created the modern state of Germany, the Franco-Prussian War, and Otto von Bismarck and Napoleon III and all that. Anyway, and the Prussian army, they were fighting with this highly highly trained group of professional soldiers, basically, like career soldiers. People are actually, you know, trained to do what they were doing very well, you know, rather than the old British system of just having sort of rich knobs in charge. And as a result, the British, they saw how effective the Prussian army was, and they abolished purchasing commissions as a result of, you know, how this war ended up, even though they weren't involved in it directly. Anyway, all this beside, you know, it's beside the points, by the by, here, because back in 1803, MacGregor's family, they bought him a commission, and he's off to fight Napoleon, heading first to the south of England, and then to Guernsey, and then eventually Gibraltar, so out on there on the Iberian Peninsula, down the, you know, at the mouth of the Mediterranean there. He manages a few more promotions during his time there. He ends up as a captain. This wasn't cheap either, but he found a new source of income, which was very useful for him in the meantime here. In 1804, he met a woman named Maria Bowater, who was the daughter of an admiral and related to two generals. Now, I ain't saying he a gold digger, but Maria is from a very, very wealthy family indeed. And when they get married in 1805, MacGregor snags himself a stonking great big fat dowry. So he's doing all right for himself as the captain of the 57th foot, rich wife next to him, scrapping with Napoleon down there in Spain and Portugal, having a good time. But by all accounts, he did a pretty middling job. He didn't seem to be a particularly remarkable soldier, officer, or anything else like that. He did a reasonable job, you know, never really overperformed or underperformed, just a bog-standard officer there. But he ends up quitting the British Army in 1810 after a big bust-up with one of his superior officers. He finally hangs up the boots on the 24th of May, 1810. And this date is important, right? And I'll tell you why. The 57th Regiment of Foot, it made it a real name for itself. So obviously he's a member of this. He's one of the captains in the 57th Regiment of Foot. And it made a real name for them. They made a real name for themselves at the Battle of Albuera, right? Fighting against the Spanish there during these Napoleonic Wars. And as a result, the 57th Regiment, they got the nickname the Diehards because they refused to surrender to the French when they were, you know, hopelessly outnumbered, heavily surrounded, having a terrible time. But they refused to surrender, and they helped to carry the day for the British in their eyes, even though it was a pretty indecisive victory there for the British and the Allies there. But still, the 57th Regiment of Foot were instrumental in doing this. Now, MacGregor, as a member of the 57th, he made good use of the regiment's reputation. Of course, he's trying to big it up in the future like this, make himself sound like a big hero here, despite the fact that the Battle of Albuera took place on the 16th of May in 1811, just shy of a year after he'd left the army. So this should give you an idea of what this bloke is all about as a con man here, because the fact that he wasn't there at the battle didn't stop him from making a big deal about, you know, being part of the 57th, being one of the diehards, so as to impress people, as we'll find out. So sort of setting the stage very neatly there for what MacGregor was all about. Anyway, just in case you were thinking that MacGregor was a very subtle man, but, you know, I'm sort of painting this picture of this delicate con man here. That's not the case. Let me, you know, he's not gently ensnaring people in tangled but believable untruths here. Let me put your mind at rest. He is not a very subtle bloke at all, because this guy was just a huge, big, gutsy liar. He really was. After retiring in 1810, he moved back to Scotland. He set up shop in Edinburgh, where he referred to himself as a colonel, even though he was just a captain. Never mind, you know, he hadn't risen any higher than a captain. Don't worry about that. I mean, who checks these things, right? He goes around calling himself a colonel, and it doesn't stop there. He wore the insignia of a Portuguese chivalric order that he'd never been given. And he bought himself a big fancy carriage, and he'd cruise around Edinburgh in this carriage, big colourful carriage it was, doing bloody sick doughies and burnouts all over the place. Sick, mate, sick. Anyway, he was absolutely obsessed with prestige and status, as I said. During his time in the military, it already had been very obvious, but now that he's out, all he seems to care about is being admired and being adulated by people. Now, interestingly, no one in Edinburgh is all that impressed with him. Obviously, you know, the Scots aren't so easily taken. It takes a lot to impress them, of course, and he actually gets so sick of his failure to break into the high society of Edinburgh that he packs his bags and he takes his wife down to London, down in 1811. He moves down to London, where, again, he's telling the same tall stories about all these... Oh, actually, no, he's not telling the same stories. That's the thing. He actually doubles down. So he's still, you know, lying, talking out his ass about his rank and his prestige and all that sort of stuff. But now he's calling himself Sir Gregor MacGregor, right? So now he's a knight all of a sudden, and also a baronet. So he's a proper member of the minor nobility here. And on top of this, he even starts to talk about himself as though he's the chief of Clan MacGregor, if you'll believe it. So he's really bigging himself up. And unlike in Edinburgh, people in London bloody lap this up. They can't get enough of it. So he starts moving in all the circles of high society, hanging out with rich knobs of all kind, and this is exactly how he likes it. It's not too difficult to imagine what kind of a bloke he was like. You know, he's 24 or 25, he's cashed up, he's full of himself. And I think, you know, we all know a Gregor MacGregor in our personal lives, really. We all know a Gregor MacGregor or two in IRL, don't we? Anyway, Things take a turn for the worse for poor old McGregor here in December 1811. You know, he's doing all the rounds, the social rounds of London, and then all of a sudden, things come crashing down when his wife, Maria, dies. Now, obviously, he's pretty cut up about this, but perhaps not for the reasons you imagine. He's obviously devastated to have lost all the money and the connections that his wife provided him for. I mean, yeah, what's that? Maria herself? No. I mean, you can always get a new wife, can't you? But all that money, irreplaceable. Anyway, it actually turns out that, no, you can't always get a new wife, because McGregor, he starts to toy with the idea of, you know, he basically starts to hunt down a new heiress that he can marry and start digging for that gold once again, but realized very quickly that this was damaging his reputation, his standing, you know, as a respectable and wealthy gentleman. So, you know, even back then, desperation was a pretty powerful mood killer, it seems, and people weren't too keen on McGregor going around and you know, sniffing at the purse strings of all these young women. Anyway, this leaves him with two choices. You've got two choices here. He can head up back to Scotland oversee his ancestral McGregor farmland, the homelands that he's inherited off his dad up north. Or he can go, oh, bugger this, I'm off for an adventure. And you're probably going to guess which one he goes for, because, yeah, we're talking about him here as a, you know, adventurer and not a farmer. So at this point in history, there's a fair bit of unrest in Latin America. A bunch of Spanish colonies are rising up against Spain in central and the north of South America, so around where modern-day sort of Venezuela is. And this is because the Spanish are pretty heavily occupied fighting with Napoleon, and as a result, the colonies sort of picking their moment here to strike and while the iron's hot, and try to unpick a lot of the Spanish colonial rule, you know, in this part of the world. So in 1811, Venezuela it declares its independence, and the revolutionary general Francisco de Miranda is in charge of this revolutionary effort, trying to establish this Republic of Venezuela down there in South America. Now, what has this got to do with Gregor McGregor? Well, apparently, and this isn't 100% certain, but apparently, maybe, General Miranda may have met Gregor McGregor when they were both in London, because McGregor was up in London trying to canvass for allies. Obviously, the British were at war with the Spaniards as well, and as well as Napoleon there, and they were Miranda was looking for ways to if anyone would be interested in coming down and giving the Spaniards what for down there in South America. Now, even if they didn't actually meet, even if McGregor and Miranda didn't meet, McGregor was a huge fan of how much everyone in London loved this General Miranda boy. You know, he's exotic world traveler. He was sticking it to the Spanish. Everyone's a big fan of him. So our mate McGregor, he thinks, I'm going to do that. I want to turn into one of these General Miranda types here. He gets the idea in his head that to cruise down to Venezuela, answer the call, get in good with the general, and go back to the soldiering life with this new Venezuelan republic. So as a result, McGregor, he sells all of his Scottish property, and in 1812, he boards a ship bound for the other side of the Atlantic, and he sails down there, bold as brass, but ready to go, ready to chuck some punches around. And in 1812, he arrives in Caracas, there in modern-day Venezuela, and he finds the city in near total ruins. Oops. It's not as a result of the Spanish, actually. It's because a fortnight before he had arrived, a huge earthquake had basically leveled the city. Now, this wasn't good news for the revolutionary forces there, because the Spanish armies, they were sort of closing in. They're getting closer and closer and threatening to recapture it. Obviously not ideal for the revolutionaries there. And for this reason, because they're getting increasingly desperate, when McGregor rocks up to say, you know, g'day, how you going to Miranda and all the rest of them, and ask for a job, the Venezuelan general, he's pleased as punch. He's got this experienced British officer coming out of the woodwork just like that. So an absolute godsend for him. He's absolutely loving life. Because think about it. McGregor's, you know, supposed credentials are excellent. He's a decorated army veteran. And of course, don't forget, he fought with the 57th Regiment of Foot, who were sometimes known as the diehards. Doesn't matter that he wasn't there at the same time. Obviously, you know, he just lets people make that link in their minds. Although actually, while he's telling these big stories about who he is and what he does, that sort of stuff, he leaves out the fact that, it's not even a fact. He's tricking me. It's 200 years later and he's still tricking me. He leaves out the total lie that he's a baronet in this staunchly anti-monarchist republic. He obviously doesn't want to, you know, bring in any orders of nobility into this republic here. So, this goes to show that he knew how to read a room at the very least. Anyway, the Venezuelans, as I say, they can't believe their luck. They immediately appoint McGregor as a colonel in the Revolutionary Army, and they put him in charge of a cavalry battalion straight away. So funnily enough, you know, with this big reputation going in to lead this cavalry company there, funnily enough, McGregor actually justifies the faith that the revolutionaries put in him. As the first battle that he fought in, he successfully routed an entire Spanish detachment. And this means that the result of this positive battle for it, he rode that wave for a long time. He used it to cover up other areas where he wasn't, you know, maybe perhaps a little bit deficient, and where it didn't, things didn't go quite so well. Because, to be honest, like, the rest of his encounters with the Royalists went from average to poor, but he managed to con the Venezuelans into thinking he was doing a great job, always reminding them, you know, this, of this cavalry company he commanded to begin with. So he's back in his element. It really is fair to say he's back in his element. He's enjoying the prestige and the glamour of his position. And in 1812, it's going very well for him, because he gets married again. He gets married again to another very wealthy lady, a woman named, and I'm going to give this one a good go here, Doña Josefa Antonia Andrea Aristeguieta y Lovera. And, you know, I understand that there are some interesting naming traditions in Spain. I don't know how they fit them on their driving licenses, to be honest. Anyway, he also gets another promotion. This time he's been promoted from colonel to brigadier general. So you think that everything is going very, very well for our mate. But in truth, it was not, however, because in July 1812, or, you know, it went all right for a while, but then it starts to fall apart. In July 1812, the revolution basically has collapsed. Gregor MacGregor is forced to flee Venezuela on a British ship to Curaçao in order to flee the conquering royalist Spanish armies that are wiping the floor with the revolutionaries here. And with the Venezuelan revolution in tatters, MacGregor, he's at a bit of a loose end. He gets bored of Curaçao very quickly indeed. He doesn't enjoy that island living for too long. And before long, he's off in search of adventure once again. This bloke can't be contained. He needs to be getting up and about and, keeping busy. He hears that there's more revolutionary activity in New Granada, which is west of Venezuela, up towards Panama. And so he decides to go there and see what's what. So after dropping his new wife off in Jamaica, he cruises down to meet General Antonio Nariño, the big cheese in New Granada. Now, MacGregor turns up and says, "G'day, General, how are you going?" He name drops Miranda and chats all about his, you know, quote-unquote achievements in the past. And once again, he cons his way into another high-ranking military commission. This time, he's in charge of 1,200 soldiers. And again, he does a competent, if unexciting, job of looking after them. And now, look, I don't want to make it seem like this bloke is completely inept at what he's doing, because he's certainly not. Like, he's definitely punching above his weight when it comes in and conning his way into offices that he didn't deserve. But, you know, he's not terrible at his job. He's still a competent military officer. Even with his competence, he's unable to, you know, sort of turn the tide of the war, and that tide is indeed turning against the revolutionaries in New Granada. And by 1815, MacGregor is fighting a hopeless battle against the Spanish royalists in the city of Cartagena, where he and about 5,000 defenders are being blockaded. The port's been blockaded by Spanish warships. They can't. The Spanish have attempted to attack the city, but it's been defended successfully by these 5,000 blokes. So they blockade the harbour. And now ultimately the revolutionaries are going to, you know, they know they're going to be starved out eventually. They realise they've got no chance. And so what they do is they arm some gunboats, they load them up with the people that wanted to escape, and they actually blast their way through the blockade. And MacGregor is commanding one of these gunboats. So he escapes Cartagena successfully. He escapes the war in New Granada unscathed. And again, in helping people escape and commanding one of these gunboats, he does a pretty good job. He does a decent enough job. And I guess I'll explain here. The reason I'm telling you about MacGregor's, you know, again, relatively unexciting military achievement, it's not to make him seem like he's bad at his job, because he wasn't. He was competent, if nothing else. The reason I'm focusing on his rather unimpressive and, you know, average career as a soldier and as an officer is instead to give you context for how he then went on to present himself later on and talk himself up. You know, for example, right after leaving Cartagena, blasting his way through this Spanish blockade, he then sails back to Jamaica, and there he meets up with his wife, right, and he starts making inroads with the rich and powerful people who lived there in Jamaica at the time. He impressed everyone at dinner parties and, you know, all that other sort of stuff by talking a huge game about how he had single-handedly defended Cartagena for as long as possible before, you know, overseeing the entire evacuation himself. And as a result of this, like, again, people are listening to this, they're falling from hook, line, and sinker. And one idiot called him the Hannibal of modern Carthage, which, as you know, anyone who has listened to episodes 40 and 41 will know, is not true at all. Anyway, it's not long before he's back in action. Again, you know, he enjoys all the hobnobbing and all the rubbing shoulders with the rich and famous, but he does want to get back to the life of high adventure. And this time, he ends up fighting for Simon Bolivar, or Simon Bolivar. I don't know. I'm just going to go for Simon. It's spelled like Simon, and I'm an idiot Anglophone, so Simon it is. So Bolivar is sort of in charge of the effort for Venezuelan independence at this stage. This is 1816 now. And again, very, very happy to have this experienced and storied British military commander, this officer come in with a rich list of achievements, a CV as long as your arm, all that sort of thing. He's going to be an asset to the Venezuelan movement for independence there. And so he gets put in charge of a contingent of soldiers who immediately get an absolute hiding from the Spanish, and they need to retreat very, very quickly indeed between cities. They're actually retreating to a city called Barcelona, which is very confusing. Not the Barcelona in Spain, the Barcelona in Latin America there. Now, MacGregor has another rare moment of brilliance while he's marching these troops toward Barcelona. They're marching there for over a month, and they're being very quickly pursued by these Spaniards. Now, what MacGregor does while they're going through this marshy, boggy kind of area, he realizes that he actually needs to stop and make a stand at one point, and because otherwise the Spaniards will eventually, they're better equipped, they're better fed, and they're going to overtake him. So what he does, while they're halfway through this big, marshy, boggy sort of thing, he finds a bit where there's a bit of a stream, and then he sets up all of his troops, a lot of them are locals from the area, a lot of them armed with bows and arrows, and he sets them all up on one side of this marshy stream, right? And then when the Spaniards arrive, all laden down, they get their horses, whatever else, difficult to cross the stream. He's set up this big line of archers to just cut them down one after the other. And so he does manage a pretty brutal routing of this Spanish force that was chasing them down. And he manages to get all of his troops, or most of his troops at least, safely back to Barcelona there. And of course, I mean, this was impressive. We've got to hand it to him. But he talked a huge game about this victory. And he's already, he's already glowing reputation, burnt even brighter. Nice one, Gregor, mate. He's done pretty well for himself. And of course, this big game he's talking, he rides that wave. Don't think for one second he doesn't make the most of it. He made sure that everyone and their dog knew about just how well he'd done there. So much so that he actually got a letter of commendation from Bolivar himself saying, and this is what the letter said. It said, "The retreat which you had the honor to conduct is, in my opinion, superior to the conquest of an empire." So big words, big bloody words from Bolivar there. Anyway, not long after this in 1817, the revolutionary armies, they decided on a different tack, right? They've been harrying the Spanish, trying to fight for the independence at home, and they decide they're going to try to draw the attention of the Spaniards away from this area in Latin America, and decide that instead Spanish-controlled Florida would be a good target. They decide that MacGregor is the man for the job, going to start leading raids and attacks, invasions on Floridian soil. So he ends up traveling up to the United States. He travels up to the US, he goes through Pennsylvania, he goes through the Carolinas, he goes through Georgia, and he's going around trying to recruit American citizens, US citizens, to attack Florida, which obviously wasn't part of the United States at the time, it was part of Spain. So at this point, we see some classic MacGregor behavior. And now, and for the first time, he's actually starting to rip people off from their money. He's starting to part people from their cold, hard cash, because he's going around making big promises about all the rewards they'll get if they come and fight and invade Florida, all the land and the riches and all that sort of stuff they get. But he also encourages people to invest, and he's fleecing money off them. He's basically selling the titles to land that he's planning to conquer with the money that he raises. So he's selling essentially stocks and shares in Florida itself, promising these investors huge big returns, great big tracts of lands once it's conquered. And he even says, just for good measure, he says, look, if it doesn't work, 100% money back guarantee. I don't know what these turkeys are thinking, giving them the money, but that is what happens. And he raises $160,000 at the time, millions and millions of bucks it is. He raises so much money. And of course, these poor people, they didn't know at the time, they're getting fleeced. They're incinerating their money. After the whole affair was over, they never saw the slightest return on their investment, but that's Gregor MacGregor for you. He's come in, he's just emptied their wallets. Anyway, once he's stacked up enough cash from these poor old Americans, he's got enough people as well to start the invasion. He's got enough of a backing from a lot of the US people who were keen, again, to expand their territories and get amongst it there like that. Once he's got everything ready, he gets a couple of ships together and sails to a place called Amelia Island. It's up in northeast Florida. It's right at the top of the, I believe they call it the Panhandle. I've never seen a pan or a handle that looks like that, but sure, all right, no worries. So right at the northern end of that there. And Amelia Island, it's full of crooks and criminals it is, and he decides that this is going to be the staging point. This is going to be the launch point for the invasion of Florida. But obviously, you've got to capture Amelia Island to begin with. Now, it is property of Spain at the moment. There is a Spanish detachment on the island, but no worries. After having reached the island, he decides that he's going to land his troops, invade, take over the garrison, and that'll be that. So on the 29th of June, 1817, he lands his troops, all 80 of them, and they go up to the Spanish garrison, which were fully armed with cannons and everything in their big fort there. And he tricks them into surrendering because there are only 50 Spanish blokes. And he points at the ships and says, "Oh, mate, you don't even want to know how full those are. These 80, whoa, that's just the vanguard. You just wait till you see how many other blokes I've got." And the Spaniards go, "Oh, yeah, look, fair enough. You got us. We'll run up the white flag here. We'll throw in the towel because we've had enough. We don't want our asses handed to us here." So by managing to make himself seem much more powerful than he actually was, he captures Amelia Island. Brilliant. He captures, you know, what a legend. Easy game. Get around him. He's an absolute hero. But rather than use it to further the various fights for independence that are happening down in Latin America, what he does instead, bloody twist ending here, he decides, "Oh, bugger that. I've just captured this perfectly good island for myself. This seems perfect." He tries to set up a government on this island and declares himself the head of the new Republic of the Floridas. It's got a flag and everything. It's got a green cross and a white background. Imagine like the English flag, except with a green cross instead of a red one. And he starts going about doing all government stuff, like trying to tax people and whatever else. And he effectively has tried to just annex this island and turn it into his own little private, you know, sovereign nation. Now, you'd be surprised to learn it doesn't last. Doesn't last at all. All the blokes that he's brought with him, they keep saying, "Well, mate, are we going to go and invade Florida or what? You know, what are we even here for?" And he's going, "Oh, yeah, no, we'll send out some people." And they, you know, sends out people and they get killed by the Spanish who are, you know, currently occupying Florida. And they come, they don't come back. "Oh, no worries. We'll get to it, lads. We'll get to it. Let's enjoy our time here at the Republic of the Floridas." Anyway. He eventually loses a fair bit of favor with the troops he's supposed to be commanding because he doesn't pay them. And this is not a good move for any military leader, of course, not pay. An army marches on its stomach, that's what they say, but also on its pocketbook, I think it's fair to say. And he doesn't pay his soldiers. And when this starts to become an issue, he starts to make, or basically not quite forge, I guess, just draw Amelia dollars. He starts to make fake money which he uses to pay them. It's obviously worthless, and this doesn't go over too well. And as a result, as you can imagine, the Republic of the Floridas is extremely short-lived. Just a few months later, what finally ends it is the Spanish have finally begun to rock up to reclaim their possession of Amelia Island. And as a result, you can see them on the other side of back on the mainland there, getting their troops together ready to recapture it. And he's not an idiot, McGregor. He's not an idiot. And he realizes that the jig is up. He decides to leave. So he gets back on board a ship with a big crowd, apparently. He's getting on the ship. They're booing him and hissing him as he finally, you know, leaves with his tail between his legs. He heads off to Nassau. But no regrets. Leaving the island to, you know, be recaptured by the Spanish, leaving all the people there behind. He leaves one of the Americans that he'd brought with him. He used to be, I think, a Pennsylvanian congressman. He leaves him there in charge of it and says, "Oh, yep, good luck to you, mate. I'll see you on the other side." And gets in his ship and sailed back towards Nassau. But even this, the fact that he abandoned the island basically to the Spaniards, even this, it doesn't stop him from, when he gets back to Nassau, ordering commemorative medals made to honour his time in Amelia Island. And they are engraved, they're emblazoned with the words Amalia Vini Vidi Vici, which of course means Amelia, I came, I saw, I conquered. And even better than this, Duce Mac Gregorio Libertas Floridarium, or in Latin, which is Latin for Liberty for the Floridas, under the leadership of McGregor. So this bloke really had tickets on himself, you can see. And it didn't end there, of course, because he tried to spin the Amelia Island affair as a win, straight up just lying to people and saying that after having captured the island, he then sold it to a French privateer for $50,000, who said he'd defend it from the Spanish, which, long story short, he did not. And as a result, back in Nassau, he's living large once again. People seem to eat up his story, and his wife gives birth to a young son on the 9th of November 1817, who was rather inventively named Gregorio. So he's having a great time. He's back in his element. He's loving life once again. And, I mean, at this stage, you're probably wondering if this bloke just kept his head up, you know, that far up his own ass for warmth or what. But I'll tell you this. It gets a lot worse. It gets a lot worse because this whole capture a town and then leave it to the dogs ends up being a bit of a trend for our mate McGregor here, because he does have a couple more wild adventures in the coming years. In 1818, he finally leaves Nassau again on the hunting for adventure once more. This time he's heading back to Britain because he's heard a story about, once again, revolutionaries, Latin American revolutionaries in London trying to gather troops to fight the Spanish, just like General Miranda was all those years ago. Now, he wants to lead these troops. He reckons he's the man for the job, and so he heads back with Josefa, his wife, and little Gregorio, his little son there. He heads back to London, and back. And once he's back there, given his military background and his experience in Latin America, and, of course, the endless number of lies he's telling about himself, he's actually given charge of a contingent of British troops that are being sent to help the Venezuelans fight the Spanish. Now, this makes sense on the face of it. We've got a bloke here with, you know, a lot of military experience fighting with the British Army, and then a lot of local experience in Latin America fighting with the Venezuelans and whoever else like that. So he is a good fit if he's... But, I mean, everyone lies on their CV, right? But some people lie just a little bit more than others, especially bloody Gregor MacGregor. Anyway... He picks up these troops, he picks up the money that he's supposed to use to fund the trip, which he very quickly and very efficiently squanders completely, and he sets sail for New Granada, crossing the Atlantic in early 1819. Now, even at this stage, even early on, his troops, they are unhappy, they're mutinous, they've been promised a big payday after arriving on the other side of the Atlantic, and once they get there, old mate MacGregor, you'll remember, he's already frittered away the money, he's got nothing to pay him with. So as a result, it's all that he and his second command, who's a bloke named William Rafter, it's all they can do to try to keep order amongst the soldiers here. They manage to placate them in the end. They manage to say, now listen here, boys, it's going to be all right. They promise them with make all these promises about loot and riches, you know, once they've started to attack the Spanish and capture their towns, and they'll have their pick of the litter there. And then that's backed up by MacGregor's immediate announcement. They're going to set sail straight away and attack a town called Portobello. Now, they do this. They set off very quickly. They arrive at Portobello on the 9th of April, 1819, and they land a force big enough to overtake the Spanish garrison there without a fight. Now, you know, again, I don't want to take too much away from Gregor MacGregor because he has managed to capture a couple of Spanish towns, but what is going on with these Spaniards? Why aren't they fighting? All of a sudden, these British rock up, they land 200 blokes on the beach, and they're just like hands up, red, you know, white flag straight up in the air like this. I don't know what's going on. Anyway, another glorious victory for MacGregor anyway you slice it. But rather than continue the fight and march on to Panama City for the glory of the revolution, no. MacGregor decides instead to hang about in Portobello. And apparently he spent most of his time there chilling out in the tropical sunshine and designing the trappings of a new chivalric order of his own invention, the Order of the Green Cross, right? And so that's how he's spending his time there instead of doing all the warmongering that he was supposed to do. And his troops, you won't be surprised to learn, are not very happy about this at all. Morale plummets into oblivion. They're not bothering to even bloody patrol the town properly or anything like that. And this leads to disaster. They've got these slovenly troops who aren't, there's not a modicum of order or discipline there. So on the 30th of April, when the Spanish arrive once again to recapture the town that they've lost, MacGregor was actually sleeping in bed. He was having a sleep in, snoozing away when the fighting started. He hears these gunshots, these rifles going off there like that. Do you know what he does? He grabs his bed, he chucks it out the window, and then jumps out himself, lands on the bed, goes down to the beach, and tries to swim out to his ship. Like an absolute coward. And he nearly dies. He actually nearly drowns. He's dragged out of the water like a half-drowned rat onto his ship. He coughs up his water and like that, ready to go. Anyway, all the people on the ship, you know, they're all ready to, you know, for him to give the order to bombard the Spanish forces with the ship's cannons and you know, try to save the town from being recaptured by the Spaniards. Because Rafter, you know, you remember this bloke, William Rafter, he's 2IC. He's there fighting off the Spanish back in the town there along with all the troops that were left behind on shore. But you know what he does? In what most historians like to describe as a real dick move, MacGregor turns around his ships and he orders them to weigh anchor and completely abandons Portobello along with all the troops, William Rafter in charge of them, everything like that. They're just left behind on shore. He flees to the high seas. This whole thing is obviously a pretty bloody rubbish bit of behaviour from MacGregor there, but... He tries to take everyone's mind off it in a pretty interesting way. He gives all of the people who are on the ship with him, he gives them all medals and awards for, you know, this new chivalric order that had been working on, the Order of the Green Cross, as I said. But, I mean, it's not... it doesn't really make everyone feel all that much better because, you know, they're thinking of all the people who have died back there in the battle. And Rafter himself, he's captured and later executed when he tried to escape from Spanish custody. So a very sad ending for the people left behind in Portobello. But unbelievably, this isn't the last time that he... This is not the last time that Gregor MacGregor captured a Spanish town and then abandoned it when the Spanish came to, you know, to save his own skin here. He actually runs back the exact same situation immediately afterwards, this time in a town called Rio de la Hacha. So after all this in Portobello, McGregor, he heads to Haiti, where there are some more British troops. They're waiting for him to attack another town on the Spanish town there. And he loads all these troops up into ships, and he sails off to capture another town. Now, McGregor, he tries to spin what had happened to Portobello, but the cracks are starting to show because the troops are abandoning him left, right and centre. They're hearing the stories that are going around, and the leadership isn't great. And of course, the fact that they still haven't been paid, which is not a good idea. So with the blokes that are still remaining, he sets off towards this town, Rio de la Hacha. And on the 29th of September, 1819, he arrives at the town with 250 troops. He had started with 900, but as I say, hundreds and hundreds had left or been killed. And with these 250 troops, he orders an attack on the town. He says, "You blokes, you get off the boats, you go down there, I'll get myself ready. I'll lead this attack personally on Rio de la Hacha. I'm going to come down and I'll lead it personally." So in readiness for the attack, the troops leave the ships. They leave under the commands of a bloke named Michael Rafter, who is the brother of William Rafter. He had specifically purchased a commission on this trip with McGregor to Rio de la Hacha to try to rescue his brother, who he thought was still a prisoner of the Spanish. So Michael Rafter, he takes the troop ashore. He takes all the troops ashore. He lines them up, all ready to attack, and they all wait for McGregor to come down and lead them. And they wait, and they wait, and they wait some more for about 2 hours, and McGregor just doesn't turn up. So he's talking a big game. He's just talking, he's flapping his gab. He's a big lobster treatment. He's going bap, 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 telling them all about how he's going to come and fight the battle, and then he just doesn't. And by this stage, after 2 hours, the Spanish have actually decided that enough is enough and that they are going to be the ones who attack after all. So in spite of McGregor not being there to lead, or maybe actually because of McGregor, the fact that McGregor wasn't there to lead them, Rafter is now forced to lead the British in a counterattack against the Spaniards who are lining up to attack them. And if you believe it, he leads. It's an absolute success. He routs the Spanish. He captures the city single-handedly. Rio de la Hacha falls to the British hands. And just like that, another Spanish town has fallen to McGregor. Well, not to McGregor, but of course he's going to take the credit for it, isn't he? Rafter has taken this town for the British. Absolutely brilliant. What a great effort from him. And McGregor, who seems to have blundered and tricked his way into another stunning military victory, actually doesn't believe that he's won. He's convinced that the British flag that's flying above the town is a ruse, and he won't get off his ship until Rafter's rows out to tell him that everything is okay and the attack was fine, right? So eventually he comes ashore, he tries to take charge, but people are very, very all these troops, they've had it up to the back teeth. The last straw was him not coming on, on shore to actually lead the troops personally like they said they were going to. So they've absolutely had enough of him. He tries to placate them once again. He comes out, makes a big announcement about it all, at the end of which he describes himself as His Majesty the Inca of New Granada, which doesn't go over too well. I don't know about you, but I reckon at this stage, old mate McGregor is a few sandwiches short of a picnic here. He's going around talking about himself like that. But once again, this speech doesn't help. Of course it doesn't. Obviously it doesn't help. Morale is horrific. The troops are not fans of McGregor at all. If you think it was bad before, it's even worse now. And discipline now breaks down completely. They're drinking in the streets. They're partying. They've got no discipline. There's no sense of order or urgency or anything, anything remotely approaching, military discipline, as I say. And Michael Rafter actually wrote about this whole affair later on. And this is what he had to say. He said this: "General McGregor displayed so palpable a want of the requisite qualities which should distinguish the commander of such an expedition that universal astonishment prevailed amongst his followers at the reputation he had for some time maintained." In other words, these blokes couldn't bloody believe how big a talk this bloke could talk without walking the smallest of walks. Soldiers, they're going around pissed as chooks, the town is in total disarray, and sooner rather than later, the Spanish are getting ready to recapture the town. Now, eventually, Rafter, he rather sensibly decides that they've got no chance at all against the Spaniards, and so he and a stack of other officers and soldiers, they bugger off all sneaky-like in a captured Spanish ship. Now, this is good news for the officers that are left behind, however, because for them, once McGregor realizes what's gone on here, all of his other officers are buggered off there. What he does immediately just promotes all of the officers who stays behind. The promotions all ran, handshakes, orders of the Green Cross, of course, chucked in for good measure. Bloody brilliant, nice one, all you blokes, congratulations. The bad news, however, is that they've got no chance against the approaching Spanish armies, and I reckon that McGregor knows it. And the reason I think he knew it is because of this. What he does And remember, we've already seen him be a bit of a mongrel so far, but this one takes the cake, what he does next. As soon as he's finished promoting everyone, handshaking, you know, kissing babies, giving out the orders, the Green Cross, whatever else, as soon as you know, he's finished saying what a great job they're going to do fighting off the Spanish, he heads down to the docks. He heads down to the docks with some of the officers' families. Ostensibly, he's, you know, escorting them to the ships there as in readiness for the upcoming battle. Very gentlemanly of him indeed, you would have thought. Right until he also jumps on a ship and orders them to weigh anchor, once again leaving most of his officers and troops ashore just in time for the Spanish to invade. This Spanish attack recaptures the city rather effortlessly, and all of the British that are left behind, well, it is not a particularly happy ending for them, that much is certain. So, for those keeping count at home, that's a total of three times at Amelia Island, in Portobello, and now in Rio de la Hacha that MacGregor has captured, with a big emphasis on the inverted commas there, a town before more or less abandoning it to save his own skin. And so far, MacGregor has largely avoided the consequences of his buffoonery. Three towns abandoned to the Spanish, hundreds of pounds embezzled or lost, you know, made up titles and overblown achievements. Up until now, everyone has kind of fallen for it. But now, in the back half of 1819, things take a huge turn for our mate MacGregor here. Because after leaving Rio de la Hacha, he sails back to Haiti and he finds that his luck, at long last, has finally run out. This time, he's not able to pass off what happened in Rio de la Hacha as bad luck, or as he's not able to spin it as a victory or find a silver lining, anything else like that. He's not able to pass it off as anything other than an abject failure for which he is catastrophically at fault. And worse yet, he receives a letter telling him that Josefa and Gregorio, his family, they've been evicted from their home in Jamaica after people have heard what he's been up to, MacGregor's been up to. And even worse than that, right, Bolivar, he's run out of rope with his Venezuelan mates, because Bolivar has got wind of what MacGregor's been up to, and he threatens him. He says if he ever sees him again, if he ever sets foot on the South American mainland once again, he'll hang him. So he is well and truly at the end of his tether. He's run out of all his goodwill at this stage. He's not very high on old time sake with any of these blokes. So what did he do? What did he do at this point? The short answer to this is, we have absolutely no idea. We have no idea what he did. Because after October 1819, Gregor MacGregor disappeared from history. We don't know where he went or what he did at all. Talk about laying low. This bloke is one of the most outlandish and interesting figures in history, and he just disappeared. But not for long. As you'll discover next week, in April 1820, MacGregor resurfaces, he re-emerges, and he begins what becomes known as the Poyet Scheme. He conned millions and millions and millions of pounds out of people by inventing a fictional country in Central America and persuading them to invest or even emigrate there. It's an incredible tale that puts people like, you know, Charles Ponzi and Bernie Madoff, it puts them to shame, and you are not going to want to miss it. And that is what we are going to cover next week. But that's it. That's all she wrote today, sports fans. That is half of the story of Gregor MacGregor. I'm sorry to have split it up over two episodes. I imagine it's a little annoying, but as you can see, we're already well into 40 minutes of episode time here. And there is just so much to get across with this bloke that I thought it was best that we do the whole story rather than try to condense it in there like that. So I'll see you back here next week for more nonsense with Gregor MacGregor and the Poyet Scheme. Very, very interesting tale indeed. As I say, you're not going to want to miss it. Anyway, all the boring, normal housekeeping stuff to close out the show. Halfasshistory.net. You can send me an email just like Casper LaGrasse did. I'm so sorry, Casper, that I'm not saying your name correctly. And I've also had emails from a bunch of people. I talked last week about the fact that the podcast wasn't available on Google Podcasts. Apparently it is, but it's not available on the Google Play Store. And I just can't get it on there because I'm not North America. So I do apologize to the people who only access it there. You'll have to use something else, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, you know, Google Podcasts, whatever it is, whatever else it is, you'll find it there, hopefully. Let me know if there are any issues. But it's always good to hear from people. If you've got topic ideas or, you know, suggestions or feedback, I really do love to hear from the listeners. And a very special thank you to the Patreon members. I've got a couple of new patrons who have just signed up recently. And again, it floors me. It's just so humbling that people give me money for this stupid, dumb podcast. Anyway, That's that for another week. I'm looking forward to bringing you the story of the Poirier scheme next week, that we'll finish the story of Gregor McGregor. But until then, of course, leaving you with a question posed on Reddit. This question, we talked about Latin America, obviously, and this is a question adapted from one asked by Reddit historian Newpong, who wants to know, why and when did they stop speaking Latin in Venezuela?